Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. We are online at commonwealthclub.org on Facebook, Twitter, and check out our YouTube channel. My name is Barry Eisler. I'm a novelist, a blogger, and a former CIA operative, and now your moderator. It is my pleasure to introduce today's speaker, Annie Jacobson, former contributing editor to the Los Angeles Times Magazine and author of Phenomena, The Secret History of the U.S. Government's Investigations into Extrasensory Perception and Psychokinesis. I had to look at that word a little longer because it's hard to pronounce. This is the book. I know everyone on the radio can't see it, but I'd like to show it to you. It is such a great book. I got a little bit more about Annie. Annie Jacobson is an investigative journalist and best-selling author who writes about war, weapons, U.S. national security, and government secrecy. Her Area 51 was an international bestseller, and The Pentagon's Brain was a Pulitzer Prize finalist. Now she has written what she says is the definitive history of the military's decades-long investigation into mental powers and phenomena. Ms. Jacobson says that for more than 40 years, the U.S. government has researched extrasensory perception, using it in attempts to locate hostages, fugitives, secret bases, and downed fighter jets, to divine other nations' secrets, and even to predict future threats to national security. The agencies involved include the CIA, DIA, NSA, DEA, Navy, Air Force, Army, and even the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Ms. Jacobson's new book, Phenomena, tells the story of these radical, controversial programs using never-before-seen declassified documents as well as exclusive interviews with more than 50 former CIA and Defense Department scientists, analysts, and program managers, as well as the government psychics themselves. Please welcome Annie Jacobson. So I was just chatting with Annie in the green room, which is always the privilege of a moderator at one of these things, about this amazing book. We're going to have a lot to cover in just 65 minutes. But I'd like to start with a pretty broad question. For anyone who doesn't know and is surprised by the fact that the U.S. government has been investigating some pretty way out stuff for decades with significant resources, Annie, can you just bring everyone up to speed on a high level of what the U.S. government has been doing with extrasensory perception investigations, psychokinesis, and related phenomena?
Well, first of all, thanks to the Commonwealth Club for having me, and welcome everybody here to talk about an interesting, controversial subject. To your question, I report on DOD programs, intelligence community programs, in all four of my books, I found it all leads back to the Nazis. And so that's where this began, which is a kind of curious and somewhat sinister way to begin, but the intelligence, military intelligence, captured a trove of documents after the war called Das Annenerbe, and it was Heinrich Himmler's science organization, and this particular cache of documents looked at extrasensory perception, knowing things beyond the five known senses. Psychokinesis, the idea that you could bend matter with your mind, that you could move matter with your mind. Map dowsing. And so the government got interested in this because we were interested in anything the Nazis had done for technical intelligence purposes. And also because guess who got the other half of the documents? The Soviets. So it kicked off the psychic arms race, if you will. And year one for the CIA, 1947, they got right on this. What I thought was most remarkable was to learn that these programs, when I initially started reporting on the subject, I thought they were kind of buttoned up in the 1990s with some of the more famous programs and the downfall of the remote viewing program. But in fact, I was astonished to learn that here we are today, 2017, programs are still going on, but now they're under the rubric of high technology. So instead of being called things like extrasensory perception, they're called anomalous mental cognition. And, you know, here's another one out of the Office of Naval Research today. It's called sense-making. And that is defined...
If only we could get the government to do that, to make sense.
But it's ambiguity and vagary and everything, but it's just extrasensory perception dressed up in a modern term.
I always find it fascinating how the government thinks it can rename things and therefore somehow rehabilitate them. I mean, it's not torture, for example. It's enhanced interrogation. They're not prisoners. They're detainees. They're not wars. They're interventions. We can always prettify things if we just change the name somehow. You mentioned the remote viewing program. Mm-hmm. I think this is probably the best known, to the extent people know about these programs, probably the one that was most controversial. I would love to hear a little bit more about remote viewing.
So remote viewing was a fancy name for ESP. The CIA came up with that term in the 70s. And the program went on right here in your neighborhood at the Stanford Research Institute. Looking at declassified documents, I was amazed at how there were these extraordinary success stories with remote viewing. Yes, there were huge, colossal failures, but there were also some remarkable experiences that the CIA chronicled. They would put psychics in laboratories, in a Faraday cage, which is an electronically shielded room, and they would begin with very simple, what were called what's-in-the-box test. I mean, they would literally put a box in front of the psychic with a lid on it, he couldn't see in it, and say, what's in the box? And if they passed the test, they would kind of go from there. And before you knew it, they were looking into classified facilities, you know, seeing places that were 3,000 miles away. But what was so remarkable with some of the psychics is they, and again, this is the declassified documentation showing that there were ways in which these psychics knew things that they couldn't possibly know. And what was really remarkable to me on some of the cases that I found most alarming was DOD would come in and investigate CIA because they were like, who's the spy? You know, who is in your organization? They thought there was a mole inside CIA because some of these psychics were able to access highly classified information. I mean, secret NSA facilities buried deeply underground, and there was no way they had access to them. So, yes, big failures, but extraordinary, weird, spooky successes.
Better than chance could explain, is my understanding.
And it depends who you ask.
Right.
You know, this is really a story. I mean, the narrative that I write, I think, is about the reaches of what can be known. I mean, that's what you're talking about. What is possible for man to know? And on another level, the book is really about science versus the supernatural, because there are many scientists, the scientific skeptics, if you will, who say, this is utter nonsense. This is sheer bunk. And let's be clear about the scientific method. I mean, scientists have agreed since the scientific revolution that you have to have five processes. And most importantly, an experiment has to be repeatable for it to move from hypothesis to general theory. Well, the phenomena, extrasensory perception, remote viewing, psychokinesis, these are fickle by their very nature, meaning, yes, the CIA, the DOD has demonstrated there in laboratories that this is happening on occasion. So on the one hand, you have the scientists who are in the work that say, oh, it's fickle by its very nature. Then you have the scientists who are the skeptics that say, hogwash, nonsense, get rid of it, crazy.
One of the things that I found so interesting about the book is this story of the tension, the battle between skeptics and believers, mm-hmm. between what are sometimes known as sheep and goats. Why do you think some goat fetishists here? Why do you think there's such hostility to the notion of what are sometimes called paranormal mm-hmm. phenomena?
Well, I think before I began investigating this, I wasn't really clear on that. And I was interested to learn that a lot of scientific skeptics are also atheists. And, you know, never has religion or faith come into any of my reporting until this book. But it's pertinent, so I reported the facts. So on the one hand, you have scientific skeptics, and on the other hand, you have the people in the work. And they divide into two categories in my experience. This is the scientists, the physicists, and the psychics themselves. Some of them believe that this extrasensory perception, sense-making, if you will, advanced intuition, that it is biological in nature. Right. And so perhaps the best analogy is what some of the scientists said to me, think Mozart, right? Annie cannot sing in the shower. Think of Mozart's music. So I would be called normal,
right.
And Mozart would be a supernormal, not a paranormal, but a supernormal. So that's biological, physiological. That's what the DoD is interested in today. And then you have another group within that group that says, no, 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 it's something else. It's something without. It's not within, it's without. And now you're getting into the realm of the supernatural. I mean, faith, right? Yeah. Consciousness. Yeah. And that is the point of contention for most people.
Yeah, the hostility I find interesting, because my take on these sorts of phenomena is, if there's science to it, the science is not yet understood. I think Arthur C. Clarke had that famous expression, the supernatural is merely science not yet understood. So I don't greet it with open arms or with hostility. It's more like, let me look at the data. Let me ask the audience a question. Do you know the name Ed Mitchell by any chance? Does that ring a bell? Some people, not that many. I have to admit, the name wasn't familiar to me when I read the book. There's a really great, interesting, and moving section, and then a coda about Ed Mitchell. He was an astronaut, the fourth man to walk
Six.
On the moon? Sixth to walk on the moon. And, why don't you tell the audience a little bit about what Mitchell did, his own personal psychic experiment on the way to the moon and the fallout from that.
So all of my books come from an idea, or usually so far come from an idea while researching the previous book. For writing the book about DARPA, I was looking at space a lot, and I was looking through the Apollo image library. I came across what I thought was one of the most remarkable photographs I've ever seen. It's in the book. There's a man on the moon, an astronaut, and he's reading while on the moon. He is holding a piece of paper. Man on the moon reading. And I thought, my God, what is he reading? So I tracked him down. That was Ed Mitchell, Apollo 14. I went to his home and interviewed him in Florida. And I said, what were you reading on the moon? And he said that he was reading a map. So it was a man on the moon reading a map of the moon. On the moon. And I said, why were you reading a map of the moon? And he said, very seriously, because we were lost. Now, this really was amazing to me because my book is about, it is a quest narrative, but it's about getting lost. And it's when you think of science and you think of explorers, being lost, getting lost is part of the journey. How do you get back? I mean, the book has lots of people who get lost and stay lost. But what happened to Mitchell was really remarkable because, as he told me, they had flown 240,000 miles to get to the moon. Mitchell was the pilot on the Antares lander craft. He hit his target within 87 feet. That was the record on the Apollo missions. And then they got lost locally. I mean, think
about it. What are the chances?
And, you know, it led to his, he was already prone to psychic functioning. He was secretly conducting experiments on the moon, ESP experiments. But the disappointment that he felt on the moon for getting lost, because they weren't able to reach their target, which was Cone Crater, they were supposed to grab some rocks that would apparently, geologists believe, you know, perhaps reveal the origins of the moon in terms of the Earth. And he was so disappointed on the way home. As he explained it to me, he looked out one of the five windows on the spacecraft and had what he called an epiphany. And he said that in that moment, he realized that man was more than his scientific brain, consciousness.
That we're all connected by consciousness.
We're all connected by consciousness. Yeah, and that began his journey.
That was one of my favorite chapters in the book. It was incredibly moving. And it wasn't even mostly about the psychic experimentation. It was actually about this trip to the moon and back that nearly went awry. But so Mitchell, because he was interested in consciousness and some other topics, conducted a psychic experiment on the way to the moon. He just had three people back on Earth, and he said, okay, at such and such a time, I'm going to concentrate really hard on certain shapes, the classic square, circle, star, wavy lines, that kind of thing. And I mean, it just seems like, from my standpoint, it's an interesting idea, harmless at worst. I mean, what's the big deal? But somebody leaked it, and for the rest of his life, he was, well, until he was out of the public spotlight anyway, he was dogged by this stuff. Like, people were jeering at him because of it, right?
He was ridiculed. I mean, he told me a story of sitting there in quarantine after they got back from the moon with Alan Shepard, his fellow Apollo 14 astronaut. And it had leaked out in the press. And Shepard was like, look at this. Look, the press will say anything. My God, they are shameless. They said you conducted ESP experiments on the way to the moon. And Mitchell said that moment of truth. And he said, I did. And he said the look he got from Shepard was just a sleigh.
And I find that so interesting on at least a couple levels. First, because it's just interesting that with certain exceptions, like the hardcore new atheists, I'm not a religious person myself, but I certainly don't sneer at people who say believe and like have traditional notions of God. I don't know. It's not really subject to proof, right? It just doesn't seem like something that's worthy of sneering about. I don't know. And so why would, like, if Ed Mitchell said, hey, I'm a religious man, I'm a believer, right, everybody would be like, oh, that's beautiful. In fact, you practically have to say that to run for president, right? Whether you are or not, to be taken seriously. Right. But if you say, like, well, I think there might be something to ESP, so I conducted an experiment, people start rolling their eyes. That's a really interesting inconsistency in human nature. And the other thing is that this story you recount is in a book about how the U.S. government over decades has spent tens or hundreds of millions of dollars investigating these phenomena. And Ed Mitchell did it for free, right? It's like a benefit to the taxpayer. And people sneered at him. Yeah. But when the CIA does it, it's like, oh, that's sense-making. Oh, right. That's right. Remote viewing. Yeah. That's so... It's the oddest thing. It's like that George Carlin thing where he talks about religious believers versus UFO hobbyists. He's like, they get relegated to with the phrase hobbyist, like it's something we shouldn't take seriously. So Ed Mitchell was a hobbyist, and that's worthy of scorn. But when the CIA and the DIA spend tens of millions of dollars, it's like, well, this is serious stuff. I don't know. I just found that discrepancy super interesting.
It's one of my favorite stories in the book, and I'm glad you pointed it out, and I agree with you, because, you know, here was a guy who was also, by the way, a scientist from MIT, with a PhD from MIT. He was no slouch, but he suffered tremendously. I mean, no story was ever written about Ed Mitchell after he came back from the moon without a snickering journalist pointing out that he had conducted ESP experiments.
Yeah, when you read about what these men accomplished, what they endured, how they prepared, how much training it took, what it takes to travel 240,000 miles to the moon and back in the most hostile environment you can imagine, things going wrong, staying calm and focused and rational and problem solving while all this is going on. To think that people would make fun of this guy, I'm like, what have you done?
Well, I'm so glad you pointed it out. You know, it's... you can read 1,000 pages worth of Apollo transcripts, or you can read my summation of it. But I'll give you one little note of what happened on that you're talking about. They were first of all, it was Apollo 14. Well, that comes after Apollo 13, and you know about that. There was so much pressure on the astronauts to not have anything go wrong, to the point where they were told not to say anything. There was a major problem that I write about. And NASA said, like, you can't land on the moon yet. You got to go around the dark side one more time. Think about it. Like, and by the way, we're not going to have any contact with you. I mean, this is what they had to go through.
Even if it wasn't the moon, that would be scary, right? Somebody just telling you have to go around the dark side one more time. I'd be like, do I have to?
Right. Yes, and so what they went through and the accomplishments that they did, and again, it also speaks to human physiology. I mean, is it within, is it without? I mean, what the astronauts were able to accomplish was remarkable. And again, this led Mitchell to some very interesting places, but he suffered for it.
Yeah, needlessly, it says the people who jeered at him, it says so much more about them than it could ever say about him. Mm. There's just one little thing that I love the way you recount in the book. So the abort sign comes on. Like, they're going to land on the moon, and suddenly the screen starts flashing, abort, which is really serious. Like, you can't land on the moon. You have to come back now to come 240,000 miles back. And so they're all trying to figure out, like, what should we do? We've only got seconds. We're running out of fuel and stuff. And NASA's running through all the different scenarios, and nobody thinks it can land. And then some technician says, could you just tap the screen? Yeah. Mitchell's like, what? Because just tap the screen. Somebody's just like, and the abort sign goes off. That's the best. Yeah. Oh my God. So of all these different programs that started with the end of World War II and the recognition by the Allies that Himmler had been looking into all these different occult areas himself, and that a lot of what he had gathered and learned had now been acquired by the Soviets, producing the greatest Smith versus the Joneses national security race, I guess, in history. What were some of the greatest endeavors of these psychic programs? So the book is has a lot about the research, but then also about the deployment. What were some of the really big deployments that the government used its research into psychic phenomenon to in the field?
Well, you bring up an interesting point, because the different agencies that were involved always embarked upon a research program. That was generally their plan. Let's spend 3 years researching this, and then we'll decide if we're going to go operational. And then there would be some kind of national security crisis. For example, one of the big programs had to do with the Iran hostages, locating them. So they're researching it, and suddenly, you know, all these guys are taken hostage, and there's an emergency crisis from the Joint Chiefs of Staff saying, oh my God, we're missing 7 guys, right, that cannot be accounted for. They're not in hostage situation A. Where are they? And, you know, technical intelligence could not find them. So they looked to the remote viewers. And these guys were able to produce their locations in a manner that no other hard intelligence collection situation could. So that's what's called an intelligence first. And the Joint Chiefs of Staff then said, this is a serious, we need more of this. And then it goes operational. So you had a lot of hostage locating, because in the early 80s, there was Hezbollah, it was kidnapping everybody across Lebanon. And so these guys were used to try to locate people. And there was always an intense rush. And it was interesting to look at these documents, because you're looking at very early drone technology, which I wrote about in some of my other books, in the 80s, when the Israelis, when Mossad was leading drone technology. And you have drones kind of complementing what the psychics are saying in this, you know, effort to locate people with an incredible ticking clock before someone's murdered by Hezbollah. But another situation which I found remarkable, I don't think it had ever been reported before, was after Reagan declared the war on drugs, the military was brought in, and this was an astonishing development, where suddenly the Navy's looking for drugs. You know, big loads of cocaine coming in from the drug cartels, and they couldn't locate them. Again, satellite technology cannot see inside of a giant vessel. So they brought the psychics on board, and through this very occult, supernatural, you know, quasi-science, pseudoscience, if you will, form of map dowsing. I mean, Himmler used to do it. His people, the Nazis, would do it with swinging a pendulum over a map to locate, you know, subs, allegedly. Well, we're doing this in DOD under these extraordinary circumstances, and the psychics, in many situations, are actually locating numerically, oh, I see, you know, going like this with the map, then going in closer and closer till they're doing this with the boat that they've, you know, identified, and then locating where on the vessel the big load of cocaine is, and then the Navy interdicts, and there's the cocaine. So, again, I mean, coincidence, luck, pseudoscience, fact, fantasy, science, supernatural, this is the battleground of phenomena.
So the military, according to its own studies, and the CIA, according to its own studies, believes that there is merit, that the powers they have been investigating and trying to develop are not mythological. It's not pseudoscience. There's something to it. That's the conclusion.
That's the key conclusion by some. I mean, there are also other theories. There are theories, you know, the placebo effect, that you're finding something because you believe you can find it. The self-fulfilling prophecy idea. There's such a debate over all of this that it's hard to really put a finger on their pinpointed conclusion. But again, going to the modern era, what is fascinating is that now you're looking at an entirely different playground, if you will, because we're no longer, we being DOD, is no longer using the parapsychologists of the 70s. They're using neurobiologists, computer technologists, computer engineers. They're taking soldiers in the field who are psychic, bringing them back, and then mapping their brains and modeling their brain behavior. And, as it was said to me, then trying to accelerate it. That's the plan. And of course, when you're talking about DOD, you're talking about weaponizing it.
As a thriller writer, I feel bad saying it, but I love when the government does stuff like this. I mean, I don't even have to think of plots anymore. I'm just like, well, that's going to be a great story. So, yeah, and apparently this research, this experimentation is ongoing. It's not what you have not written. You've written a history of these. You've written a book about the secret history of these investigations, but it's not just history. Is that right?
That's right. I mean, it's contemporary. And what I find even more interesting is because I write about, you know, national security and secrets, many of what I cover, much of what I cover is through the Freedom of Information Act request. And we're talking about declassified programs from 25 years ago. And what I report in all of my books is, okay, so here's what people knew at the time, kind of the tip of the iceberg, and then here's really what was going on. So when you look at what I'm able to report in the last section of the book now, I show you what I would assume is the tip of the iceberg. Yeah. And there is a lot more there, and one can only imagine what is being pursued.
And that's my job as a novelist. I'm always imagining that stuff. And what I imagine is that you could get the U.S. government to look into anything by saying you have some intel that the Chinese are doing it. Or better yet, these days, the Russians are doing it. If the Russians are doing it, done. You could get research into anything. People sometimes ask me, do you think the U.S. government has really done experiments and has ever investigated time travel? I'm like, are you kidding? Of course they had. Somebody told them the Russians were doing it. So we had to do it too. Just a quick reminder for the radio audience. This is the Commonwealth Club of California program, and we are talking with journalist Annie Jacobson about the government's experiments and investigation into extrasensory perception. I'm Barry Eisler, your moderator. You can listen to Commonwealth Club programs on the radio or podcast, watch our YouTube channel, check out our website, and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Okay, surprised to see that we only have one question from the audience, but I need not be surprised. Actually got dozens. But Andy, I want to ask you this. How accurate are the X-Files paranormal, not alien conspiracies?
Look, you know, science fiction and science fact merge. In fact, what my last book on DARPA, the DARPA director was actually quoted as saying, you know, in response to the book, well, here at DARPA, this is where science fiction becomes science fact. So, again, it goes back to that idea of what is possible in the age. I mean, the age that we live in is very, very different than Himmler's, you know, pseudoscience. So I think more will be revealed, but I always think, and we'll leave it to you to write the fictional versions, but there's a real, you know, people love this battleground, if you will, because you mentioned the sheep and the goats. I mean, it was Gertrude Schmeidler, the Harvard experimental psychologist who came up with those terms. And she said, on the one hand, you have goats. These are scientific skeptics who say hogwash, nonsense, full stop, period. And on the other hand, you have sheep. Sheep are open to the idea of ESP. Don't have to be convinced, but to your question, open to all of that. And what is fascinating is a new Gallup poll shows that the sheep are the minority, even though they're the vocal ones that you hear often. And the goats are the minority with 24%, and the sheep, people in America who are open to this, open to the X-Files in real life, are 76%.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
That's actually encouraging for me to hear, because I think the notion of saying, oh, there's nothing to this stuff, it's almost the assumption that we know everything about the world, about the universe that there is to know. There can be nothing mysterious. It's all been discovered. And that's unlikely to be an accurate position to take, I think. In fact, there's some discussion in the book on possible scientific a possible scientific basis or number of different bases for these phenomena. One of them is relatively recent. I guess it's quantum entanglement theory. Would you like to talk a little bit about that? Because I find that stuff really interesting.
Well, I interviewed the lead scientist who led the CIA program and the DOD program, and then wanted to know a lot about what they were doing today. And they're all still in the work, if you will. And one of the scientists, Dale Graff, who started the DOD program, works in what is a very kind of, you know, controversial area always about, which is called retrocausation, which is this idea based in quantum entanglement that what happens in the future affects the present. And I think that I do a better job quoting others, as in the book, about this kind of science. But, you know, it lives in the world of what Einstein called spooky action at a distance. That if you have two objects, no matter where they are, far away, they are entangled. And
I love that phrase, spooky action at a distance. It's the title of a new book on this topic of quantum entanglement. And I know very little about this stuff, but if you're interested, Google quantum entanglement. It's super interesting. It's what Annie's talking about. And anyway, some people think that this could be the basis for what we experience as psychic phenomenon. There's actually some sort of physics explanation for it. And my feeling is, I don't know. I mean, I have internet knowledge of this stuff, but it interests me that there are people who have no more knowledge than I do, and maybe even less, who are like, oh, it's all bullshit. Bunk. Apologies to the radio audience.
One of the things I will say I did whenever I'm working on a book, I always kind of do like some deep background research that just has to do with my own thinking. Visited the Oracle at Delphi in Greece, went to the British Museum and looked at, and this is to your point about how it's so hubristic to think we know everything. And I looked at the earliest forms of writing, the cuneiform, and there was a, then you move forward 2,000 years to 600 BC. The British Museum has what remains of the collection of King Ashurbanipal of Assyria. And he had collected what he said in his writings, cuneiform writings, were all the knowledge of the world in this one place. And there were little maps of the world and the universe as they knew it. And this idea that we know everything is always very interesting, and it kind of moves forward with the age.
Yes, so interesting. Okay, some more questions from the audience. Wouldn't someone with ESP be afraid to come forward for fear of being a test subject?
I mean, I wouldn't know.
I knew you were going to ask that.
I mean, the psychics that I interviewed, Uri Geller among them, he was a super interesting one because he was a CIA asset. And, you know, I spent a lot of time with different individuals talking with them about what their experience was and whether or not they ever felt pressure by the government. And, you know, I think they're very interesting narratives individually, but basically what it comes down to is the different individuals who wind up working for the government that are psychic really just believe that they have this power. I mean, they have no attachment to what other people think about it. I mean, often when the media comes in with a person like Geller, it becomes a big story. But for the most part, they just kind of accept it a bit the same way that probably Mozart accepted that he was exceptional.
Right. Were the Nazis successful in using the paranormal? I'd say not at the strategic level, but I don't think that's what the questioner meant. Right? Are there any known instances?
I don't know of any instances, but it also, the Nazi stuff is so sinister because it all rested on, you know, Himmler's pursuit of this idea of the Uberman, you know, the Superman, and then therefore to prove of the Untermensch, the subhumans. And so he was really playing with that racial idea of the great Teutonic, you know, man, and that's what most of his supernatural, that's what his investigations were based on. And so I think that's where most of the stigma of the occult and the supernatural really comes from, certainly in the government, because it's associated with Heinrich Himmler.
That's why the government had to change all the names of the
That's why
the
it's now
programs.
Sense-making.
I've actually got ESP. Right, exactly.
Yeah. Right.
I've got just a general question I'm curious about. It looks like as a journalist, you focus mostly on big government programs, DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. So this is like the big government think tank looking into some way out futuristic technology, and Area 51, and now, of course, psychic phenomena, Operation Paperclip, really interesting story about how Alan Dulles and the CIA brought Nazi war criminals into America, whitewashed their record of atrocities so that we could take advantage of their scientific and intelligence value. Like just big governmental spooky programs. Where does that come from, do you think? How did that become your beat?
I mean, I've always been looking for a great story. I'm a failed novelist. I went away to boarding school at age 15 with a typewriter wanting to write the great American novel. And I spent decades, you know, with no one reading anything I was writing. And a mentor said to me when I was actually 35 years old, when I said, should I just give this up? I mean, I have literally not sold a single word. And she said, stop making stuff up. Just go after the truth. It's the truth that matters. And so I began my career as a journalist. And she also said to me, she pointed out that I had a little trouble following direction. And she said, you can't just run with these made up ideas, right? We'll leave that to you. You know, you need to follow you've got to develop craft and follow what your editor says. And that's what I did. And I just worked as a journalist, doing whatever was there. I was a financial reporter, and then fate and circumstance intervened. That's a different story, and I got onto the path of writing about national security.
And so this is now your thing. I mean, it's what you're known for. Yeah. And you obviously seem to have a knack for it. This book is such a great story. And it's funny you said like you were a failed novelist, because what they would call in television writing is the act outs, you know, right before the commercial break, some big thing will happen to keep you tuned in and staying through the commercials, or chapter endings in a novel. It's the same kind of technique. You don't want the person to go to sleep. So you want to have some kind of, I mean, like every chapter ends that way in this book. That's when he decided he would, I forget the guy's name, but he would follow this research to the gates of hell. And I'm like, oh, come on, man. It's like 2 o'clock in the morning.
Well, all right. Well, fate and circumstance did intervene for me in a different way. I was doing a talk at the library, which I'm a big supporter of, and there, I live in Los Angeles, and there happened to be a Hollywood producer sitting in the audience, unbeknownst to me. And right when I finished the book, Phenomena, literally I hit send to my editor and was like, I wonder what I'm going to do now. And then I get this email from the big producer, and he says, listen, I'm the producer of the new Tom Clancy series, Jack Ryan. Will you come be a fiction writer for us? And I thought, you know what? I'm not going to turn this down. So I went and did, you know, wrote the new series with a bunch of other writers.
That's
so
awesome.
It came around full circle to fiction. So I have now written fiction, television, but I really enjoy reporting. It's where my heart and soul is. And I'm so happy to be at a place where that's supported, where, you know, the job of the reporter is just to report the news. I mean, I write right down the middle. There's so much polemics involved in this subject. You can read pro psychic functioning. You can read anti-psychic. But I try to tell the story, as I do with all my books, right down the middle. Interview people from both sides of the aisle. They can't both be right and they can't both be wrong. So what is the story? Well, you get to think about it, because really all of my books are about perspective. They're about point of view, you know, and people interpret things differently. I mean, that's what happened to Ed Mitchell on the moon. When you read about that, they're lost on the moon, and he and Alan Shepard are arguing with each other. No, we have passed this rock, you know. It's so simple, right?
It was an amazing scene. It's interesting. I think there's probably, and I don't mean this in any kind of derogatory way against journalism, because there are some really bad journalists out there, but of course there are some great ones too. The line between fiction and nonfiction is not quite as bright as a lot of people think it might be. It's all storytelling. You're taking facts, but there's no objective way to perceive the world. You have to do something to arrange those facts. You were using the phrase like right down the middle. I wouldn't use that phrase myself, because I feel like just because there's one side and another side, it doesn't mean the middle is the accurate side. Like people who laughed at Ed Mitchell, I think they're just wrong. The correct story there, like the, for me, the meaningful story is there, is that this guy did something meaningful, had a meaningful epiphany, did something worthwhile, and that people who jeered at him were making fools of themselves, not making fools of him. And that's definitely not a middle line view.
So on counterbalance, yeah, I'll tell you something that my editor once said to me when I was writing the Operation Paperclip story about the Nazis. I mean, if there was ever a time when I felt I had a horse in the race, meaning an opinion, it was that. It just the things I uncovered and the national security, you know, documents that I got, FOIA requests. I found one war criminal, literally Otto Ambrose, Hitler's chemical weapons engineer, convicted at Nuremberg, you know, was released, you know, gotten out of prison by us and brought, and part of an Atomic Energy Commission program. This was reprehensible. And I'm there working with my editor, and he said to me at one point, well, let's just have a little, why don't you do some more interviews to really pull up this idea about, that you've touched upon, that there was, it was important that we brought these German scientists to the United States to work on our weapons programs to beat back the Soviets. And it was like, you know, the fingernails that, like, I got to go back for more of that. Like, didn't I say enough of that? I mentioned it. And he said, no, try to be more thorough. And I did. And, you know, when I was doing the publicity tour for that book, I would go on a very, you know, conservative television show. And they would say to me, Annie, thank God you wrote this book. You know, you uncovered all this information and you actually showed to us that even though these were horrible Nazi war criminals, it was necessary or we'd all be speaking Russian right now. I would go on a very liberal television show or the Holocaust Museum, and they would say, Annie, my God, thank God you wrote this book. I mean, you showed us that we should never in a million years have had this program. Well, they both read the same book.
Right. The conservative show was wrong, by the way, because Americans Americans can't learn foreign languages, whether it's Russian or anything else. It's like that joke, you know, if you speak three languages, you're a trilingual, two languages bilingual, one language American. Did Ed Mitchell ever mention Carl Jung's collective unconscious theory?
Great question. I didn't talk about that with Mitchell, but I did talk about it with a number of other scientists, and I write about Jung in the book at length because he gave us this much to think about with the idea of the collective unconscious. Interestingly, Jung spent decades talking to Wolfgang Pauli, the Nobel laureate theoretical physicist, about ESP. And we know now, only recently, thanks to a great book, that Pauli was actually Jung's patient. And they would have these discussions because of the Pauli effect. So Pauli would walk into places and the lights would go off or something would fall over. He was at Princeton once and the cyclotron blew up. And Pauli became fascinated with the idea of psychokinesis, the idea that the human body could somehow affect matter. And the two of them, Jung and Pauli, would have these discussions. Is ESP fact or fiction? Is it fantasy? Is it science? Is it supernatural? And it was Jung who spoke of and gave me that idea that I just brought up earlier, that you must define what is possible with the criteria of the age in which you live. And so what was possible 50 years ago even, you know, where we hadn't even been to the moon, and what is possible now, where, as I wrote in my last book about DARPA, the Chinese now have a supercomputer that calculates 93 quadrillion calculations per second. And as I reported in the DARPA book, in 1944, the computer was a human. There was no computer. Right. It was a human. Yeah. An army computer was a human being with a pen and a pencil who performed calculations.
This was the term, the government term.
This was the government term because there were, you know, von Neumann was working on ENIAC and MANIAC and all these different computers that first came, you know, we're talking about essentially calculators. That's what the computer was only at World War II. And look where we are now, 93 quadrillion calculations per second. I mean, DARPA is modeling, you know, a synthetic brain at Los Alamos, which I visited for the last book I wrote. I mean, what is possible now, artificial intelligence right around the corner? This is what we must define. That is the criteria for this age, I think, when we think about these subjects and what is possible.
So having done so much research in this area, including your latest book, what do you think is likely to be the most way out thing that the government is currently investigating?
I mean, I can't imagine them because I don't work for the government. But what I find scary
is writing
for
TV now. You have to.
I can't think. I got to stay inside the lines and follow the direction. It's all going to go really badly if I don't. No, I mean, look, I write about this in The Pentagon's Brain. I mean, there's no doubt that the did you say scariest?
Most way out.
So way out I see as scary when you're talking about Defense Department. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it's the creation of the human cyborg. This is not science fiction. This is science fact. This is what DARPA is doing. I write about it at length. Merging man and machine, brain chips already in the brain for many soldiers, you know, hybrid steerable animals that are going into war environments. This is real. This is not fiction. This is a book I wrote 2 years ago, so where DARPA has gone with this now, we can only imagine. That's scary.
It's interesting to consider that every new technology initially gets deployed by the military and the pornography industry. It's like Thanatos and Eros. Always. I mean, the two... I don't know whether I should be encouraged or discouraged by that. Have you had any access to the psychics used in any of these programs? That's a resounding yes, but please.
Yes, I interviewed a number of them. And, you know, what was one of my favorite psychics to interview is a woman named Angela Della Fiora. I tell her story in the book. And why she was particularly interesting to me was because she was at DOD. And the defense, whereas the CIA was going with the Mozart idea that psychic functioning, you know, psychokinesis, this is individualistic, it's biological, physiological was what they were leaning toward. It's certainly what they're looking at today. The Defense Department took a different approach. They decided that soldiers could be trained to be psychic. And that's where grave problems arose, because that seems kind of a bit of a catch-22. So you have Angela Della Fiora, who was an analyst over at DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency. And she's writing reports, you know, analytical reports. And, you know, she got wind of this secret classified program going on next door. Why? Because she's psychic. And she went to the general. She went around the military chain of command, to around all these soldiers who were training to be psychic, went to the general and said, I am psychic.
I'm already psychic.
Take me on the program. And the general was like, no, that's not how we do it. She gave him a psychic reading. You know, he's crying, and he puts her on the program.
It's another great scene in the book.
Right. Yeah. And then, you know, there are serious problems, because you now have a woman who went around the chain of the military command, who's a civilian analyst, and what the heck is she doing on the program where we're being trained to be psychic? And but what also happened was that her intelligence collection was head and shoulders above the trained psychics, which was sort of abysmal. And she had some really remarkable success stories and ended up getting a lot of sort of secret awards. I have photographs of her getting these awards in the basement of the Pentagon because no one could talk about it, because you're not supposed to say that they're psychic. They're supposed to be remote viewers. And they're supposed to be trained, and she's psychic, and the whole thing was just a mess. And it's a great story.
That actually irritated the remote viewers, right? Yes. The fact that she described herself as psychic. They're like, God, you know, we're not psychic.
Yes. They're like, we have worked hard not to be psychic, right? And now you're ruining it, literally. You know, they called her a witch. I mean, you know.
Oh, my God. Yeah. I can't believe, that's a nice segue, because I can't believe we did not answer this while we were talking about Ed Mitchell, but what was the outcome of Ed Mitchell's psychic
moon
space
experiments?
Yeah.
I mean, they were abysmal. They were part of the colossal failures, you know, and that just made it worse. And what was interesting for Mitchell, and Mitchell, when he came back from the moon, he quit NASA, divorced his wife, got all new friends, dedicated his life to ESP research, and became a front for the CIA. And that was marvelous, these documents I was able to get from the FOIA request showing how this process happened. And one of the things Mitchell did was he was assigned to bring Uri Geller to the United States. He was kind of the front man for Geller, you know, because Geller was a spoonbender and the CIA couldn't possibly be working with this guy except where they needed to, because what if he could disrupt the electronic system on an ICBM? And Mitchell and Geller became friends. And so what was interesting in interviewing both of them, I think I did the last interviews with Mitchell before he passed, and Geller, who's still alive, they just adored each other, you know, and Geller had what Mitchell wanted and Mitchell had what Geller wanted, right? And so it's this amazing kind of friendship, because Geller was a young kid. He was 22 when he just burst onto the scene and had all this press and had all these skeptics just maligning him, and he's on Johnny Carson and he can't bend spoons and he's being dragged through the mud. And Ed Mitchell, he said, would send him photographs of himself, you know, as in the astronaut suit, saying, "Go, Uri," and would call him up and support him. Yeah. But Mitchell wanted to be psychic. He wanted so badly. And since those moon experiments did not work, it was like a real, he felt sort of let down by the fact that he couldn't accomplish this.
It's strange to me that there would be this notion in the military that you could take anyone and turn them into what, in another framework, you're calling a Mozart. Like, nobody thinks that way. You could probably take anyone and improve their musical sure. ability, but you can't take just anyone and turn them into Mozart. And the military knows this. And so, like, not everybody can be turned into, for example, a sniper. Only certain people will have that level of ability. Anybody can become a better marksman, but not anybody can become a sniper. So why would they lose all? It's just interesting, almost cognitively, how they would lose that common sense framework that has guided them well in all other aspects of their training, and suddenly think that anybody can be turned into a psychic. And that actually is a nice segue for a question we have here, which is, what is the potential for the average person to become psychic or precognitive? If you had to ask the question.
Yeah.
Just kidding.
I mean, again, I don't know if you can become psychic. Every psychic person I've interviewed that worked for the government or the CIA has said that they are psychic, that they were born that way. And that now some of them also talk about, and I write this in the book, how they were psychic as children and then it went away. It sort of was beaten out of them, if you will, when they wanted to be normal. And then circumstance and fate intervened and they picked this talent back up later in life. But what I also found super interesting, and I reported in the end of the book, was that nearby at the Stanford lab right now, there is a new program going on with a professor. I don't want to give it away because it's so tantalizing, but the CIA doctors that all worked on the programs in the 70s have been working on exactly what you're talking about, what the question asks. This idea, they're mapping the cell biology and looking at DNA of deeply psychic people, many of the people who participated in the government's programs, and looking at the features with incredible, extraordinary detail because of computer technology to determine if there is what they call the genomics of supernormality, which is kind of a fancy way of saying, is there a gene for the paranormal?
Whoa. So, and if you could do it for the paranormal, why wouldn't they be doing it also for, say, musical ability, intelligence generally, physics ability? This is right. Like, so again, this is where journalism crosses back and forth with fiction. This is like The Boys from Brazil. If you all remember that story about cloning Adolf Hitler.
Well, what I think is interesting, and you can read this, is that the lab, it's called the Nolan Lab at Stanford. I mean, Professor Gary Nolan has grants from DOD, from NIH, all kinds of awards for work that he's done in oncology. But the reason why they're looking specifically for the genomics of supernormality is because that's the area that they're all really interested in. And what they are also looking...
They're all, you mean the government?
No, these particular scientists that worked on the CIA programs. And also what they're looking for is working with, you know, are there drugs to enhance it? And are there drugs to repress it?
The government's always experimenting with drugs itself and prohibiting them to the citizenry. Just seems like, I mean, and then they use psychics to find other people's drugs. I try not to get irritated by these things, and I can't help myself. Was there ESP in the animal kingdom that inspired any U.S. government programs?
That's a great question. Mm. I mean, I was surprised to find the answer is yes. One of the earliest programs in the 50s was having J.B. Rhine, who's often called the father of ESP, do these psychic experiments with dogs and cats for the Defense Department. The dog program, they were specifically trying to find deeply buried mines. But it seems very weird because dogs have this amazing, you know, sense of smell anyways, and so right. they were going after the chemical scent. But yes, there have been programs, and I write a little bit about them in the narrative.
So many questions about Ed Mitchell, which is gratifying for no particular reason for me, other than I just love that part of the book so much, and he seemed like such an amazing person who was so ill-treated by the cool kids press, who just loved to find someone to pick on sometimes. Did Ed Mitchell ever find out who spilled the beans about his ESP experiments? I guess he just knew it was one of, yeah.
I don't think he ever knew.
Yeah. Well, there were only three people it could have been, right? He had three people back on Earth.
Yeah.
That would be a great thing to be able to say. Like, none of us ever really get to say that, right? Like, my friend back on Earth. Yeah. He had three people back on Earth who were involved in the experiment, so it must have been one of three. And unfortunately, Ed Mitchell, as we know, was not himself psychic, so he wasn't even able to, you know, like, it had to be one out of three. Where did the DOD find the psychics? I'm laughing because I remember an old Jay Leno routine where some protesters in Iran were burning an American flag, and he said, I just always want to know, where do they get those flags when they want to burn them? Is there a store in Tehran that sells American flags for, you know, for angry mobs to burn? Anyway, where did the DOD find the psychics?
They actually sort of heard about them word of mouth. It was kind of like, who is the super psychic in town? And what was interesting, and you can see this in the declassified documents, is the psychics were not allowed to know that they were working for the CIA. It was like the client back east, but the psychic was always like, you work for the CIA. I mean, they were psychic, right?
That's awesome. Okay, so some novelists or would-be novelists or people just giving me some easy layups from my next novel in the audience, were psychics ever drafted or forced to work for the U.S. military? Was it always voluntary?
Oh, that is a good question. Not that I know of. I mean, can you imagine? I think the psychic would know enough to run, right, in advance.
You'd
like,
hope, but
they're coming.
Stephen King dealt with this topic in his book Firestarter. If there are any Stephen King fans in the audience who remember his book Firestarter, that's what it was all about. It's not that I take any pleasure from thinking ill of our government. In fact, psychologically, I think it's difficult for us to acknowledge all the bad acts of our own government in a similar way that it's difficult for us to imagine that our parents might not be perfect or might have done bad things or something like that. We have psychological defenses against that sort of framework. But if you just look at the history of U.S. government unwitting human experimentation, it's horrific and not very well known. And if you're curious, it's quite a dark topic. Just Google U.S. human experimentation. And if you took the country names out of it, you would, and someone said to you, okay, who do you think did these experiments on its own citizens? You would say, that sounds like the Nazi Germany, Dr. Mengele, maybe Japanese Unit 731. You would be quite resistant to acknowledging that your own government has done these things, and yet it has. I could go on about this. It's really gruesome stuff. So the notion that in the name of national security, which is our great secular religion, the U.S. government would kidnap and force into service someone who it thought had some sort of national security value, I mean, I don't even think that's controversial. The particulars might be interesting in a novel, but I wouldn't be worried that anyone would say, oh, come on, Eisler, that's way too far out there. It seems almost obvious to me. Let's see. Has there been an instance of ESP being used in the Situation Room under highly stressful situations?
Most definitely. I mean, particularly Angela Della Fiora. She was relayed many experiences to me that had to do with looking for hostages. And that is incredibly intense because they would have her, they would grab her on a Sunday and say, you need to come to DIA headquarters. And she would be sitting there in a room very mindful of the fact that a William Buckley or a Colonel Higgins was kidnapped, was, you know, signals intelligence from Mossad was saying that he was being held in a manner, and word from Hezbollah was that he was about to be killed, and could she locate him? Incredible pressure on that, because, you know, you kind of, at least the way she relayed it to me, was that you feel that this, you know, this person's life is in your hands, and no one else can do the job but you. And so, yes, I think it would carry an enormous burden and a lot of stress.
I might be misremembering his name, but there was there was an American general and high official in NATO. I think it was William Dozier.
Yes.
Who was kidnapped, was it in Italy, mm-hmm. by like Red Army faction or what, I don't remember. The U.S. government employed psychics, yeah. to try to find him?
Yes. That's right. Well, and I interviewed General Dozier, and it's a fascinating story. He's the highest ranking general that was ever kidnapped, and he was released. But even before that, there were all kinds of kidnapping threats at the time. It was right around when Reagan was shot, and you have Anwar Sadat assassinated and the Pope shot. So it was just like the world was in chaos. All these leaders were targets. Secret Service was on the job. The psychics were working for the, you know, Secret Service as well. And one of the psychics out here at Stanford, in a session that has nothing to do with it, it has to do with, is Carlos the Jackal going to kill Reagan? And he suddenly says, wait a minute, a U.S. general is going to be kidnapped in 72 hours. And he even describes like a blue panel van with foreign writing on it and a, you know, a window of time and a name. And so Interpol sends out an alert, and General Dozier is kidnapped within that exact time frame. I mean, it's, the details are in there. They come straight out of declassified documents. It's remarkable.
But Dozier, downplays all that, right?
He doesn't. Dozier downplayed it all. But, and then they put the psychics on the beat to try to find Dozier. They send one of the main characters in my book, Dale Graff, who started this whole program, they send him to Italy, so he's like in the field with the psychics. I mean, it was really a one of a kind show. But yes, Dozier, and according to Dozier, he was sitting there concentrating on his wife. I mean, it's just an amazingly human, kind of beautiful story. He's like sending out these kind of good vibes to his wife, right? Makes sense. Yeah. And the psychics are trying to locate him, and they later interpreted that when Dozier said that publicly, that that was like some kind of psychic functioning on Dozier's part. Well, I interviewed him, and he said, that's total hogwash. I was rescued by the Italian commandos, mm-hmm. you know, and he, it's a great story because, again, he's a very skeptical person, and he's allowed to be, and the psychics have their take on what happened, and he does too. But there was no doubt that that warning, that precognitive warning, was factual, intense, and inarguable. But the question that the scientists had to face was, so what? And ultimately, you know, it didn't prevent the kidnapping, and it didn't save him.
Yeah. How do skeptics explain that pretty extraordinary, I don't even want to call it a coincidence because that's the point, was it a coincidence or not, the fact that someone predicted with so much accuracy that a U.S. general was going, and there was going to be a blue panel van, et cetera. How is that explained? There's a large numbers theory, that sort of thing, the, yeah. 700 monkeys typing for 700 years.
I mean, the best answer I can tell you is the scientific skeptics have an answer for everything, by the way, the same way that the psychics will have an answer for everything. I mean, they, right. could say you and I are both wearing blue,
right.
because it was predestined, right? But again, those are both sides of the story. I mean, my favorite story, it's a little too long to tell in the wrap-up, but in the Acknowledgements of the Phenomena book, I write about one of these experiences that I heard about that is, to me, just made my jaw drop with, like, how could, I heard this story on the radio, how could anyone, I mean, I had to pull my car over and couldn't go where I was going because it was so remarkable, this story. And I'm like, I can't wait for the punchline. And then the punchline was the, you know, Professor Emeritus of the London Royal Statistical Society comes on the radio and begins to talk about how what the story that was just relayed was absolutely not a coincidence. It was simply statistics. And he gives this whole big pitch. And my head was spinning. I was like, wow. I mean, You could interpret anything any way you like.
Apparently so.
Yeah.
Okay, we've reached the point in our program where there is time for only one last question. And it says, ask the question. So, Annie, my question is this. As a journalist and as a citizen, how do you feel about the research the U.S. government has conducted into these areas? Is there more research you'd like, less? Would you like more transparency? I mean, if you could just design some way for this research to be happening or not happening at all, what would it be?
I don't know that it's really my position to sort of decide what the government does. But what I would say is my position as a journalist is just to report the facts. And what I am grateful for and continue to be interested in are the scientists, the military and intelligence scientists who work on these programs, who generally are older, and who are dedicated patriots, and who believed in their work when they were doing it, and believe in the spirit of what they are doing now. However, they're willing to talk on the record, not just about the success stories that they had, the military wins, if you will, but they go on the record and they talk about the failures. And that tends to be what people do when they get older. And I think that's super important, because if you can look at the failures honestly and openly, then you can begin to perhaps build that better system. I mean, not me, but the scientists who are working today can look and say, wow, it's really important to recognize pitfalls. It's important to recognize getting lost. And it's important to know that and to deal with that so that those same mistakes are not repeated.
That's why you want to have a map even on the moon.
Yes.
Our thanks to Annie Jacobson, former contributing editor to the Los Angeles Times Magazine and author of Phenomena, The Secret History of the U.S. Government's Investigations into Extrasensory Perception and Psychokinesis. We want to remind everyone here that Annie's book is for sale and she'll be signing copies right after the program. I'm Barry Eisler, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.